From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll tell you about a new exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum that highlights its past, present, and future. Then we'll learn about the different owls living in southeast Wisconsin in a new episode of Chirp Chat.
We've got three owls in the area that do a genuine hoot, I would think. Great horn, the barred, and the long-eared owls.
Plus, our latest Live at Lake Effect features River West's own Joseph Huber, whose unique percussion setup includes a suitcase, tambourine, and some duct tape.
And I just thought, well, I just need to beef my solo experience up a bit. So I just kind of went and got a suitcase and dived into that and tried it out. And it's kind of funny. I tried it for 2 days, and then I did a show.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. There's a new exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum. While the museum is in the process of packing up millions of items to move to a new location, this latest exhibit invites guests to learn about MPM's past, present, and future. It's called Groundbreaking, the Evolution of a Natural History Museum, and it highlights how MPM set the standard for natural history museums. It will also help guests understand why the museum is moving and what is happening to all the artifacts. Amanda Kopp is MPM's Collections Interpretation Manager. WUWM's Eddie Morales visited the museum to speak with Kopp about the exhibit.
Our groundbreaking exhibit covers over 142 years of the Milwaukee Public Museum's history, from its roots as the German-English Academy all the way through to our future building, which is set to open in 2027.
Where did the idea for this start? And I feel like groundbreaking has a couple of different meanings here in the title for the exhibit, if you could speak to that as well.
The idea came really almost 9 years ago when I started here, and I started learning all these little interesting tidbits from different people about the history of MPM, a lot of world's first, countries first. And I thought, this information is so interesting, but, you know, who would really be interested in learning about it? But when we announced the new museum being built, a lot of people started showing their interest in the history of MPM. So I and actually another staff member at the same time proposed this idea of creating an exhibit about the history of MPM. And you are right about groundbreaking as a sort of double meaning. We have broken ground as a museum that's influenced museums around the world many times, but also obviously we've just broken ground on our new site.
Can you kind of explain to me, when people first walk in, what is it they're seeing, what they can expect to see as they're walking through, just kind of generally?
Sure. So our exhibit's set up into three parts, and the first section is everything before this building, the building that we're currently in. So this covers 1963 backwards. And this area I was really trying to answer through the history of MPM, also the question of what does a museum do? So through our natural collections, our cultural collections, our education department, and of course our exhibits, which is what most people are familiar with a museum.
And is there anything from this first section that you sort of want to highlight, something that maybe we can read a little bit about or describe some of the items?
So these are two old mannequins. One thing I tried to really do is, I know people grew up here and spent a lot of time here, so there's a lot of nostalgia with this building. So I actually wanted to bring some of that out. On the external wall to this exhibit, you'll see pictures from this building, but in the past, from like the 60s and 70s and 80s. But one thing I remembered strongly as a child was coming to our old Ancient Worlds exhibit called Temples, Tales, and Tombs and seeing Cleopatra laid out on her couch. And that is the first time I remember having like an exhibit having an impact on me. And for many years, I was then obsessed with the ancient world. And when our exhibit artist, Nancy, told me that Cleopatra was still in our storage, I said, she has to come out for this exhibit. So Cleopatra's here. It's great to see her again after probably 20-some years.
You touched on a little bit of this museum being groundbreaking in several ways, like world's first and nation's first. If there's anything that kind of applies to that as we walk around, I think that'd be pretty cool to just highlight some of those specific examples.
One of our most famous ones, I would say, is the streets of Old Milwaukee. It was the world's first like immersive exhibit. I always call it that you could suddenly enter the diorama. And so that immersive exhibit style is found really everywhere nowadays, but the streets of Old Milwaukee was one of the first ones that allowed you to go inside the diorama and be a part of that experience. The Bison Hunt was the world's largest open-air diorama. Tribute was the first exhibit in the country to be made with, not just about, Native peoples. One thing I actually found out towards the end of making this exhibit is that our T-Rex diorama was the world's first full-sized dinosaur diorama within its actual natural habitat. One of the biggest impacts we've had is on the diorama itself. So the Muskrat diorama here at MPM was made by a man named Carl Akeley. And so he wanted to show how it lived in its natural environment rather than just kind of putting it on a pedestal on all four legs looking very stiff and unlifelike. And so he created that actually as a tester to show to the board to make a whole series of these. Eventually he left MPM, so he didn't make too many more here. He did make them in other institutions. But that one right there created the Milwaukee style of exhibitry, which is that lifelike, moment paused in time style of exhibiting.
Something that came to mind, though, is with, you know, mentioning the world's first and nations first, and with Milwaukee being behind so much of that, what is it about Milwaukee and like preserving history here and the people behind it?
Well, one thing I can say that a lot of people don't know is we're actually one of the first five or six natural history museums in the country. So we had a very early start in the museum field here in the United States. So I think that partially contributed to that impact that we had. Another thing is just really innovative and progressive directors that we had who really were always pushing the envelope, trying to think of new ways to do things and finding new and exciting ways to bring the history of the world and the cultures of the world to Milwaukee.
Being one of the world's first museums to co-create a Native American exhibit with tribal members, can you just kind of elaborate on this today and also where it came from a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, the history of museums and Native Americans obviously has been tenuous in the past. For a while it was, you know, a lot of that relationship was just archaeologists going and doing scientific research and taking items and then putting it on display without any consultation. I did find out that MPM, even in the 1916, was bringing in consultants from the Native American community, which I think is great, but there was still obviously a lot of work to be done. Today, one artifact I have on display is a large corn basket. It was made by a woman named Leandra Skenendor, and she made it specifically for MPM. And she talked with our education director, told her the purpose of it, and then gave her permission for us to use this object. So I put her baskets on display because that really highlights the change in relationship with Native Americans and the museum. And that is really continuing forward with the future museum. So in 2022, we hired our manager of tribal relations, James Flores, and a key part of his role here has been working with Wisconsin's 12 Native American communities to build out their stories that are going to be displayed at the future museum. So they've been involved from the beginning on saying, these are the objects that highlight our lives and our stories and our culture. This is how it should be told. And also being very receptive to when they ask for something not to be on display. And it's not just Native Americans, but throughout the world is being built from the ground up with the voices of origin communities involved.
What are some reasons, if you can speak to this, why a certain artifact might not be displayed on, based on a request?
So sometimes it is a ceremonial use that really should never have been out in the public in the first place. And sometimes we just, with working with these community groups, we think something that's a very simple object, like a fish hook, is not just a simple object. We had a group looking at some of our items recently, and fish hooks actually in that culture were passed down from father to son to grandson, and so they actually have a very strong community connection, and we just had it on display as a fish hook, and they, you know, informed us that it really isn't appropriate to display that way, and so it was taken down. One thing that we plan to include in the future museum is a tribal visit room, and what that means is a place where anybody from an origin community can see their items that we have in our collections in a respectful, nice place, reconnect with the things made by their ancestors. Some items actually need to be cared for. Some items in certain cultures, for example, are fed. And having this tribal visit room will give them the space and privacy that they can do those things and care for those objects in a cultural way while we care for them in that sort of, you know, humidity and all those other sort of ways. So this case is all about accessibility and the work that we have done at MPM to make all of our things as accessible as possible for the visually impaired, for people who might have sensory processing issues, anything we can to make the museum more friendly and a place that everyone feels welcome. We try to do that In addition to that, a really interesting fact I discovered while doing this exhibit was that when the museum was looking for visitor services people in 1892, they actually required that those people could speak conversationally in English and German because there was such a high level of German speakers in Milwaukee. And today, rather than German, we have a high level of Spanish speakers in the community. So MPM is doing a lot to present as much information as we can, both in English and Spanish. This exhibit, Groundbreaking, will have Spanish translations available both in your hand, in a binder, as well as through QR codes throughout. So one of the objects in the case is an image of a Native American man on horseback. This is an example of ledger art, which was art made by Native Americans on ledger paper. Now, obviously, for somebody who is blind or visually impaired, they would not be able to experience that. However, Don Casea, who works with our accessibility initiatives, got it made into Braille, the label, as well as made the picture embossed in a way that would be meaningful to people who aren't able to see the image itself, so they can still experience that ledger art.
So walking through and now coming to the end of the exhibit, can you tell me a little bit about the messages on the walls here, what you kind of want guests to come away with after having seen everything that we've walked through?
I kind of wanted to answer two of the main questions people have. Why are we moving and what's happening to our stuff? As I mentioned earlier, we're moving for a lot of the same reasons we moved in 1964. This building is no longer really a safe place for our collections or our exhibits, but it's more than just safety. It's also just a building that is not in line with current accessibility standards. We have really uneven floors, which were a design choice at the time, unfortunately. There's not great lighting. The elevators are very difficult for people with strollers or in wheelchairs to get into, and a lot of just deterioration in the public-facing side of it that is making it difficult to serve people and get them excited about the world today. And then in terms of what's happening to our current exhibits, I wanted to first clarify that collections and exhibits are different. Collections are the things that we own, specifically that were collected for scientific research. And we have about 4 million objects and specimens that we care for, and those are all coming with us. To the Future Museum, we aren't getting rid of anything that is part of our collections. For our exhibits, they are more the components, those the things that make up the dioramas that we see. And we are planning to bring many of them with us, actually. We have Samson, the Howler Monkey, and Granny, all those different things were definitely coming with us. But smaller components, we had to talk about how many of the trees from Tribute to Survival are going to be coming with us. So we are bringing many of those components with. The ones that we don't, we are hoping can find homes in new institutions and continue to educate in new places.
Amanda Kopp is the Collections Interpretation Manager at the Milwaukee Public Museum. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Just search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn why owls are a symbol of Halloween. But first, we'll learn about all the different kinds of owls you can find in Wisconsin and how you might be able to see one. That's coming up on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Have you ever been on an owl prowl? It's a nighttime hike in the woods where you listen for the calls, shrieks, and whistles of owls to help you get a glimpse of them. For this month's Chirp Chat, Lake Effect's Excrete Nunez spoke with Mary Hollebeck, Nathaniel Reinertz, and John O'Donnell at the River Edge Nature Center. They each help lead annual owl prowls in the Saukville area and explain how people can see and hear owls around this time of year and into the winter.
I am so excited to be chatting with you all today at the River Edge Nature Center. And today is especially fun because we'll be talking all about owls. So owls are birds of prey, but what are some characteristics that make owls different from other raptors?
There are quite a few characteristics that differentiate owls from other raptors. Owls have approximately 1 million rods per millimeter in the brain compared to humans who have 200,000 millimeters of rods. Now, with rods, that's how the bird is able to see, or we're able to see at night. Basically, rods pick up black and white, cones pick up color. So owls have a very unique system of vision and have brains that are equipped to provide them with night vision. Owls also have incredible hearing, and they have asymmetrical ears. So the left ear is positioned slightly lower than the right ear. And so the owls, by angling their heads and looking at direction of a sound, they can do what's called triangulation. So they can precisely see where the sound is coming from, and they're able to differentiate the sound of a mouse at night walking on leaves, and to know it's a mouse and not a cricket, not a frog. And it's incredible how they're able to find and easily get prey under very harsh conditions, even when it's windy.
So I also kind of want to mention some other characteristics about owls. Their silent flight, their wings.
Yeah, if you look at the margin of a flight feather of an owl and compare it to the margin of a flight feather of a songbird, it's strikingly different. If you look at it in magnification, the edge of the owl's feather is frilled. They've got little fibers that don't join to each other at the edge, where, let's say, a cardinal feather, if you look at that in the microscope, the little individual barbs of the feather join all the way to the margin of said feather so that it has a crisp edge. It looks real aerodynamic, where an owl's feather is fringed along the margin, which aids in their silent flight.
Hmm. I wonder also about their sound. Do all owls hoot?
Oh, no. In fact, only a couple of them do anything that's like a hoot. Well, we've got three owls in the area that do a genuine hoot, I would think. Great horn, the barred, and the long-eared owls. But they've all got a pretty complicated language, and some of our smaller owls do all kinds of whistles and shrieks and cries and whinnies. They also snap their bills. You have to be at real close range to hear that, but that's also part of their language, is bill snapping.
Hmm. What other types of owls can people see this time of year around southeast Wisconsin?
Well, typically we have great horned owls, barred owls, eastern screech owls, and also at this time of year we have owls that are migrating through southeastern Wisconsin, some of whom will spend the winter here. For example, northern saw-whet owls typically overwinter in southeastern Wisconsin. We also have snowy owls that come through, and it's a little unpredictable as to how many snowy owls will show up in a particular year, and that relates to the lemming supply up north. If there are lots of lemmings up north, typically then there'll be fewer snowy owls that come down.
I'm also curious, what are some reasons that owls stay in the area year-round?
Well, this part of Wisconsin has plenty of good habitat. You know, Wisconsin, first of all, is probably 70% of it is forested. And these owls, almost all three of the more common ones, do use trees to some degree or another. The barred owl and the screech owl both can nest in cavities, so they could use an old cavity. And the great horned owl will actually use the nest of other owls or hawks, and those are all birds that all nest in trees of some sort. So they rely on the forest for their food, but also for their nesting sites. You know, we aren't heavily populated like some of the other states, and further away from the city, there's certainly plenty of good habitat for all three owls to survive.
Absolutely. So for people who are interested in going out and looking for owls, can you explain what an owl prowl is?
Well, an owl prowl is a night outing. Typically, we start at dusk. We're going to have an owl prowl coming up at the Cedarburg Bog. So it goes from 5 until 7, and we basically go to two or three different locations around the bog where we're likely to hear and see owls, and we do have to use a recording to get the owl to respond. That's not something that's recommended to be done on a frequent basis, given that it would stress the owl out if this was happening often. But if we do it occasionally, and that's what we do on the owl prowl, is we do these occasionally, and we typically do get responses from northern saw-whet owls, and we do the same for eastern screech owls and for barred owls, and I don't think we've ever struck out on barred owls. They're very responsive to recordings, and sometimes we don't even have to play a recording. We might be playing a screech owl recording or a saw-whet owl recording, and the barred owl comes in, perhaps looking for breakfast, but it's a fun activity, it's novel, and we've been doing these for 25, 30 years, once or twice, sometimes even three times a year in different locations.
Oh, wow. And what are some tips to help people identify owls, especially since most owl watching happens at night, like you just mentioned?
Well, it helps to have a guide who can identify the owl. But typically before we go out, we do show pictures. We even have specimens that we have people take a look at so that they know what to expect. And if we're lucky to get a flashlight on the owl, it's typically not going to be real close to us. So mainly it's just shape and behavior, and it starts with hearing the owl vocalize, and hopefully not too long thereafter we get a look at it.
So it almost seems like your ears are your eyes in this, when you're
yes,
on an owl prowl.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
What are some things that people should avoid or not do when they're on an owl prowl?
Well, of course, if you want to hear owls, you need to be quiet, and that's oftentimes hard to do when you have a group of people together. But we normally would recommend that people, if they're going to talk, whisper. Try not to shuffle your feet too much. Most of the time, stand still if you're going to be playing a recording, trying to get the owls to respond. People are, of course, out in the dark, and they want to bring a flashlight. Oftentimes, we tell them to cover it with red cellophane, or if it's a really bright night because there's a full moon or whatever, you may not need the flashlight. Your night vision is better if, in fact, you don't have bright light around you, so best not to use the flashlight unless you need it. And again, you know, it's just dressing for the weather. And go to the right habitat. That's the best way. If you know a specific type of bird that you're interested in, you might search out that type of habitat and go to that appropriate place to find that species.
Right. I mean, all of these things that we're doing, like, this is to be respectful to the owls, correct?
Correct, yes. I mean, as we go into the winter months, the great horned owl is the first one to start nesting in the state. So by January 1st, they've already set up a territory, found a mate. They may even be already in the process of building a nest and so on. By the end of January, they're laying their first egg. So you wouldn't want to be drawing that bird off of the nest by playing a call that sounds like a competing great horned owl in the area. So being respectful and wise about when these birds are nesting. So that's why doing a prowl at this time of the year isn't as chancy. You're not drawing a bird away from its nest. You might be drawing it off of its territory, but it's not nesting at this time of the year. So, and a lot of these birds are in migration or whatever, so you're not taking them away from their young or their eggs or away from a territory that might get taken over by another species or another bird.
Right. And just to clarify, each owl species starts nesting at a different time of year.
Very true. So the great horns are the first ones, and they're the first ones in the state altogether, any species of birds start nesting. But then as we go into February, March, that's when the other owls, like barred owls and screech owls, would start, you know, setting up territories and finding a mate and that sort of thing. So as we go into the spring, all of our songbirds will be coming back then, too. And also not wise to be playing recordings of birds at that time of the year, either, to draw them away from their nests.
Right. Thank you. We're talking about all of these very cool facts about owls, but I also want to highlight the important role that owls play in our ecosystem.
Well, owls, especially something like the great horned owl, can eat a tremendous number of mice per year. So they believe one adult great horned owl could eat somewhere over 1,000 mice. And so they're a big help to farmers in that way. And if you multiply the fact that the great horned has a mate and then they have offspring, and they're feeding those offspring, the rodents that are found on a farm, for instance, that is a tremendous number of mice that are taken out of that farm field each year. So they don't just strictly eat mice. It depends on the species. Some of them eat, you know, insects and other things if they're a smaller bird. But for the most part, all of them do the same kind of thing. They're all helping to keep down the population of whatever it is, whether it be an insect or, you know, or a mouse, or might include a bat. I don't know.
Well, at the end of every Chirp Chat, I always ask my guests what bird they'd like to shine a spotlight on for the month, in this case, an owl. So what owl should we highlight this month?
Definitely the northern saw-whet owl. It is the cutest owl in North America.
Tell me more about it.
Well, when you look at a northern saw-whet owl and you see those eyes looking back at you, it's magical. And there are a few places here in Wisconsin where you can make prior arrangements to go to a field station where they are misnetting the owls at night and then banding them. And if you go and you hold a northern saw-whet owl and you look at it, it makes an impression that never goes away.
Just for our listeners who aren't familiar with the northern saw-whet owl, can you describe a little bit of what it looks like and what it might sound like?
The northern saw-whet owl is the smallest owl in Wisconsin. It's not much bigger than a soda can. It's mottled brown and blacks and whites and grays. It's got a little round spherical head with eyes taking over much of its face with bright yellow irises. What they derive their name from is the whetting of a saw. So they do a rising screech. And then they also do a territorial advertisement that is a consistent tooting, like toot, 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 a very monotone tooting. And that can rise and fall in pitch a little bit toward the end from time to time, I think when they're getting excited or territorial. But that sound really stands out in the woods at night, and you're not going to mistake it for another owl.
Well, I can't wait to see my first northern saw-whet owl in the wild one day. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you guys so much for joining me and chatting with me today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mary Hollaback is the Citizen Science Manager at River Edge Nature Center, and Nathaniel Reinarts is the Conservation Manager at River Edge Nature Center. John O'Donnell is an avid birder and involved with Friends of the Cedarburg Bog. They all spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. Some of the owl calls you heard were recorded and provided by Nathaniel Reinarts. Halloween is coming up, and when you think about the holiday, an image of a large owl perched high in a tree, illuminated by a full moon, may come to mind. As a fierce flying nocturnal predator, owls have often been associated with things like death, fear, and even witches. But how did they come to be so connected to Halloween? To find out, I'm joined by Simon Bronner, the Dean of the College of General Studies and Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. When it comes to symbols of Halloween, there always seems to be an owl either heard or seen lurking in the background. So have owls always had this association, this history with Halloween?
Not always. In fact, a lot of your listeners are probably thinking of owls as a creature of wisdom and a symbol there of knowledge, as it's used in a lot of universities and in decorations. And that certainly comes probably from their big heads and their eyes, but there's another aspect of them being nocturnal, and so they tend to take on some other kinds of symbolism.
When it comes to other symbolism with nocturnal, a little more eerie things that we're thinking about with the holiday coming up, how far back do owls date to in mythology as something being associated with fear?
Although it can't be dated exactly, many historians think that there's a connection to Roman mythology and folklore, particularly because the Romans did document their own beliefs and their proverbs and a lot of their myths, as you know. And There was a distinct connection of owls as harbingers of danger, harbingers of death. The Roman armies were traveling all over the ancient world at that time, and they would often take very seriously if they saw owls as signs of dangers, particularly in battle. The connection to Halloween is, as the Romans also conquered the northern part of the British Isles, and that's where there's some connection with the religions there, and there might have been an integration of this owl belief, which then got mixed in with their Druid kinds of celebrations, and then connections to witches, because they're both female, or the predators part were female, and also being nocturnal.
So do you think the bad rap is largely because these are nocturnal creatures and you normally see them when your senses are somewhat heightened or you're at a bit higher of a heart rate, so to speak?
Well, they're certainly noticeable also because of their noise, as well as their appearance is relatively large birds, but it's also because they're predatory. And the idea of a bird eating more than, let's say, insects or worms, they will actually eat small mammals. And so this can send a certain shiver up your spine if you see one of these, especially the female of the species being predatory on what would be vermin and other kinds of small animals. And they have sharp talons. If you ever looked at one and not looked at their head, but looked at their talons, and I'll let you or your listeners be the judge, but at least to my view, or at least the way that owls are often depicted, they have a bit of a human face, or they're thought to have certain human features, which again might raise the hair on the back of your neck.
You mentioned there was a bit of a crossover when the Romans were coming into what is England, Ireland today, and connecting with Druid traditions. Can you touch upon that a little more, on how that crossover led to this pretty cemented link of owls to Halloween?
Sure. Most people know about the Roman mythology and multiple gods. And in the British Isles, there were pagan religion, certainly, that could be thought of as animistic, if you will, is what a lot of folklorists will refer to those belief systems. And so this is the notion that different parts of the environment will have spirits. And so when the Romans came in and they had this view that the owls might be harbingers of danger, there's this idea that it has a spiritual system that is distinctive. It might be different from the trees, or might be different from the earth, or the daylight, or the sun, and so forth. So the owls are looked at as being special creatures, not one of many, if you will. And so it was very easy to then make connections of the owl to the night, the owl to predation, and also the owls, as I mentioned, being female, because they're the females are the larger of the species. The males are smaller, and that they tend to be foragers, where the females are the hunters among the owls. So either you can see this as a ritual reversal, or a one of danger that then connects up with witches, who are also typically female and then are also seen as predatory.
Do you think there's any misconceptions about owls because of their association with Halloween? You know, how do you appreciate them the most when it comes to folklore and what you've studied?
Oh, I appreciate them a great deal. They're fascinating. There are multiple species, and it should be noted when I'm talking about some of these features, they're probably in the majority species in the United States, but there are variations in all different kinds of plumage as well. They're not great in flight, and so we tend to see them perhaps more than some other kinds of birds, and they're very adaptable. as we can see. So in some ways, they're models for dealing with the night and how to navigate there. They can struggle to keep warm because they're not as waterproofed. And so I think humans can relate to that as well. They're not impervious. They do need care. And so there's a lot that can be said about them. And they also have not the best hearing, but they certainly have a very distinctive voice as well. So in some ways, people think that they hear owls communicating to each other. And there is evidence of scientists. I am a folklorist, but I know scientific evidence of people looking at their communication skills as well.
There's one other thing that owls are associated with, and that's the moon. You know, is there a connection to the lunar cycle? Because there always seems to be a full moon behind the outline of an owl, especially like a great horned owl.
Thank you for mentioning that. That is something I left out, and that is important. And yes, I think that's another connection, certainly to Halloween, and that is that owls get excited by the moon and the light because they are nocturnal. And when I mentioned about the communication, some of these communication studies have pointed out that the hoots that you think of with owls tend to increase and become much more rapid during moonlight. And so especially since at Halloween time, we usually associate it with the full moon, it's very likely that you will hear these kinds of owl noises if you are in a rural or semi-rural area, much more than might make you think that something is being haunted out there.
Well, Simon Bronner, thank you for joining me to share a little more about owl and the folklore behind it.
My pleasure, and may you always have the wisdom of an owl.
Simon Bronner is the Dean of the College of General Studies and Distinguished Professor of Social Sciences at UW-Milwaukee. We spoke back in 2021. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. We'll take one more break and then return with the latest Live at Lake Effect featuring River West's own Joseph Huber. That's next on Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Live at Lake Effect is our music series featuring artists performing in the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood. We brought the Lake Effects together, along with Visionary Studios, to showcase local and nationally touring musicians. Today, we have Joseph Huber from the River West neighborhood of Milwaukee. His music is steeped in the American folk music tradition, which he sees as spanning the spectrum of roots music while avoiding any particular genre classification. Huber also writes, performs, records, and produces everything himself. He joined us at the Lake Effect Surf Shop with his guitar and a suitcase for a kick pedal. Huber is also joined by upright bassist Eston Bennett. Here's Huber performing And the Night.
Well, I can't recall the headline. All the stars that stole their way above the lights. Oh, but I was there, and you were there, and the night. Let it mean just what it means. Let every steady hand steer with whims and dreams. Oh, 'cause all is fair when love is there, and it feels so right. When the moon shines and you fill your cup, and the dark rooms of a heart light up, every little thing, well, it's always enough. When the night falls, when the night falls, when the night falls on you. Well, we bid the day so long, breathing its final rays, and it came out a song of you and me and you, and love still strong. When you drink your wine and you move in close, and your pale skin in the moonlight glows, and you smile and you don't even know. When the night falls, when the night falls, when the night falls on. I can't recall the headlines or the stars that stole their way above the lights. Oh, but I was there and you were there and the night.
Cheers. Thank you much. Hell yeah, Estone. Give it up for this guy.
Hi, this is Trapper Shep, producer of Live at Lake Effect, and we are here at the Lake Effect Surf Shop in Shorewood, along with WUWM's Audrey Nowakowski. Hi, Audrey.
Hello, Trapper. Today we have Joseph Huber, a songwriter from River West right here in Milwaukee. His music is steeped in the American folk music tradition. He's with us here at the surf shop with his guitar, his upright bassist, and a suitcase, which he's using as a bass drum kick pedal. We're going to talk more about that later. Sure. But it's as folk gets. Welcome to you. Thanks for being here
Thank
today.
Thank you for having us here today. We really appreciate it.
I've been seeing you perform since I moved here, and not to make either of us feel old, but like 2007. And yep. One of my most memorable shows was at the UWM Union. 357 String Band played a St. Paddy's Day show. And I think it was one of the rowdier shows that UWM has ever had there. They have had the Replacements.
Yeah.
But they have had 357 String Band almost set off a fire alarm because I think someone started smoking a cigarette on stage that night. Do you remember that?
Rick was notorious for doing such things. Our bass player, upright bass player, Rick Ness, he also did that at Turner Hall, and that was just like, hasn't this place burned down like two times already? Or had at least significant fires enough where maybe this is a thing that, he got in trouble a couple times, but...
You squeaked through.
Bad boy.
Bad boy.
He's a bad boy.
For those not familiar with that group of bad boys, they were called 357 String Band, and I think one could describe them as, I read once, street grass. And I think
it's because we actually came up with that name and changed our website to that name so people would start calling us
that. That's awesome. Okay. Well that done. is great.
It's a very good reason. I'm glad you remember that
one.
Yeah,
I know a lot of bluegrass musicians who are very precious about what they put in front of the word grass.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's bluegrass, there's jam grass.
There's a lot of memes about it.
So yeah, there's a lot of memes.
Yeah.
So what kind of grass is happening today?
This is no grass.
No grass.
It's kind of funny. We played a thing in a show in Michigan last year, and the promotional poster for it said bluegrass-ish. And I thought that we were a part of an entire series called Bluegrass-ish, where you have a bunch of bands that don't necessarily fit in to the genre, and that they just like called the whole series that. No, they just called me that. And I was like, oh, I figured this out like 10 minutes before we went on. I'm like, oh, okay. So, yeah, but we have really no, I just say roots or songwriter. Mm-hmm. Roots music just seems easy enough.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like up to the way one guy plays banjo, and that can be a whole different kind of level of bluegrass. But we are big fans of 357 String Band and Joseph Huber, and thank you for being here.
Too cool.
Were playing tunes off your album Downtowner.
We did one off of Downtowner. That's the latest one from 2022. That was a song that Esten wrote called Dog Days. That was the first song that we did. And then the other ones are off Moondog, the album before that, which is probably our most eclectic album that we end up doing probably even like 40% and 50% of every show. That's kind of part of the set. So that's the one I push people towards most. So
can you share with us a little more about the Downtowner? Because if memory serves us well, you record and produce all on your own, right?
Yeah, I did that. I moved into a place that is now a restaurant. But before that, it was a building that was opposite on Center Street of the Uptowner. And it was owned by the same people at the time. So people just around the neighborhood called it the Downtowner, opposite the Uptowner on Humboldt. So I just recorded the whole thing there in a side bedroom. That was the one room that was farthest away enough from the noisiest street corner.
Yeah, that's a
absolute
that's a
chaos
location.
Corner where otherwise every single thing that I recorded has just honking sirens, all the stuff in it. And so I tucked in the back room there and recorded that whole album there the first year that I moved in there. So that is the Downtowner.
During the pandemic, I was staying home a lot, as you know, a lot of folks were, and I was getting a bit more particular about the different kinds of furniture in my house because we had to become more acquainted with these pieces of furniture around the house. And just so happens we have a master furniture maker right here in the surf shop. Tell us about Huber Woodworking.
Oh, yeah. Huber Woodworks. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I haven't been in the shop in like 10 months. It's been a long time of focusing on music and other things, but it's something I definitely will get back to in the wintertime when I hunker down and get back to it. But yeah, I mean, I just started out doing it probably 12 years ago now, and it's kind of a mixture of mid-century modern and other rustic elements that, you know, everything is pretty clean lines, but there's always one little thing that makes it offbeat.
Well, there's some Southwestern, I think, elements to it. And,
absolutely.
And
that
I think
too.
Elements of your music, like kind of the more dark gothic tones, are in
some of the earlier
in the
stuff
furniture.
I did. Yeah, has some of that. I would say gothic ones in the earlier times. Maybe
totally.
Not so much anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And speaking of making things, this isn't quite as fine-tuned as furniture, but let's talk about the bass contraption you had.
Oh, the suitcase?
Yeah, can you describe for the listeners before they're able to see it on video?
It's a Samsonite, I will say that. But this is the second one I've had of it, the exact same suitcase of. So for the past 6 years, I've had two of this identical one that I have right now.
How'd you test out what suitcase would work? How'd the idea come to you?
It came to me because I stole it from a guy who I'm a big fan of, and now we're really good friends, too. He's a guy from New York City called Morgan O'Kane, and he was a street banjo player, and he sat on a suitcase, kind of upright, different than I do, and then had a tambourine strapped to his foot, and he was doing this, and it was at the time that I started, it was after 357, and I started doing solo stuff, and I just thought, well, I just need to beef my solo experience up a bit, so I just kind of went and got a suitcase and dived into that and tried it out. And it's kind of funny. I tried it for 2 days and then I did a show and I did it perfectly. And I was like, oh, what the heck? I guess I'm capable of doing this.
Yeah.
So, I just never stopped doing it. Yeah. So,
and for those of you in the car at home as well, Joseph had a small rug and he taped his suitcase and it's the kick pedal down to the rug, as well as you taped your foot to a tambourine.
Yes.
So you're completely locked into this magic
locked
carpet.
In.
Magic of brown duct tape.
No bathroom breaks mid-set. You
oh
just
my
gotta,
God. Yeah.
You're strapped in.
Totally in.
Well, it was fantastic to not only see that contraption, but the two of you playing together and sharing songs with us here at the shop. Thank you so much.
Awesome. A pleasure.
That was Joseph Huber, joined by bassist Esten Bennett for Live at Lake Effect. Be sure to head to WUWM.com and our YouTube page to see him performing his full set with his creative percussion setup in the Lake Effect Surf Shop. Milwaukee musician Trapper Shep and myself are the executive producers of Live at Lake Effect. Sound engineering is done by WUWM's Jason Reavy. And thanks to our friends at Visionary Studios, a local advertising agency, for filming and editing this episode. Be sure to check out WUWM's YouTube page to catch up on our past episodes of Live at Lake Effect, featuring the Cactus Blossoms, Willie Carlisle, Buffalo Nickels, Raina, and many more. That's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, simply download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you listen to your podcast to hear all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow, we'll bring a special edition of Lake Effect all about the messaging on immigration in this year's election. We'll explore the history of immigrants in Wisconsin, their impact on the economy, and what a mass deportation would mean for the state. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.